This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Before I start, can I just say a few words? London, 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 London. Those are for the editors at the BBC who may want to place them strategically throughout this recording, or indeed for anyone who happens to prefer a four-syllable to a two-syllable place name. To quote Chuck Berry in My Ding-a-ling, whose lyrics in retrospect read like a first draft of the Good Friday Agreement, "This is a free country, people. You got to live like you want to live. Ain't nobody going to bother you if you do." Oh, and I need to add one word more. Legend. Because every broadcast from or about Derry in this UK City of Culture year is obliged to say it at least once. Again, I invoke the Chuck Berry clause. And if those two allusions to the great rock and roller came out as Chuck Londonberry, you'll know that the BBC editors have already been at work. The UK in City of Culture, on the other hand, was me. For the past almost decade now, the Belfast-based art organisation Factotum has published a free monthly newspaper called The Vacuum. Each issue is, or was, it occurs to me I haven't seen it for a while, themed. So there was education, there was sport, there was money, madness, those were separate issues. There was God and Satan, that was a double issue, which landed Factotum in hot water with Belfast City Council, its principal funder, due to an article in which one contributor reminisced about wetting herself in church as a child. Another issue was called Down Mexico Way. Now, anyone brought up on 20th century popular music knows that Down Mexico Way lies south of the border. The one follows the other as surely as night follows day. From this, in Belfast parlance, citizens of the Republic of Ireland, Southerners, are Mexicans. This was the sense in which the Vacuum was using it. And lest this should make any of you uncomfortable, I should tell you that one of the articles by Colin Graham is called I Married a Mexican, and recommends that everyone north of the border marry a Mexican. For what it's worth, I married a Mexican too, or possibly a Tierra del Fuegian. She's from Cork. It's not referred to in the Vacuum issue, but some people in Belfast have taken the North American analogy a step further. Derry people, by extension, are Canadians. And in case you're still doubting the essentially comic, self-ironic intent of this, think that if the South is Mexico and Derry is Canada, then Belfast in between is the land of the free and the home of the brave. You possibly saw some of that freedom and bravery being demonstrated this 12th of July with Orange Order supporters dancing on the bonnets of police Land Rovers. I say dancing, but if there's one thing that this summer proved definitively to the watching world, it is that Belfast men can't dance. The song South of the Border, incidentally, was written, perhaps this should come as no surprise, by an Irish northerner, Jimmy Kennedy, who until the Beatles came along was the most successful Irish or British songwriter in the United States in the whole of recording history. Kennedy was born in Cappa in County Tyrone in 1902, when there was no border in Ireland, although it had appeared by the time he completed his studies in Trinity College Dublin in the early 1920s. Maybe the imposition of this somewhat arbitrary demarcation, Tyrone at one stage was considered for omission from the new Northern Ireland, coloured Kennedy's preoccupations. One of his other big hits was the wartime morale booster, "We're Gonna Hang Out the Washing on the Siegfried Line." The border, I think, is responsible for my own very partial view of Derry, distorted might be a better word, when I was growing up. To be honest, I used to look at Derry on the TV weather map and wonder how it survived, way up there, so far from Belfast, and with a great big black line behind it cutting it off from everywhere else. I was encouraged in this impression by the adoption in the early 1970s of the postcode system. People outside of Northern Ireland might not be aware of this, but all Northern Irish postcodes begin BT for Belfast. BT1, the Omphalos, was Belfast city centre. I grew up in BT10 and was already flirting with Lisburn. Derry is BT48. Not as bad as the BT71 that is Jimmy Kennedy's native Kappa, or even the BT94 of certain parts of Enniskillen, but still, BT48. Talk about advertising how far you were from where the action was. And yet, from a very early age, I did find my attention drawn time and again to Derry, and not just on the weather map. Derry had glamour, or at least Derry had Dana. And there is no avoiding saying it, Derry invented the riot. In Belfast, we just burnt our neighbours out. In Derry, riots had the sweep of a Parisian evenement. It's hard to contemplate the famous slogan on that gable end at Leckie Road, "You're now entering free Derry," without remembering the so-called French law of the 10th of May 1968. First, disobey, then right in the walls. All that changed on Bloody Sunday, of course, but then everything changed on Bloody Sunday. Colm Tobin joined a march to the British Embassy in Dublin in protest at the killings, a march that ended with the embassy going up in flames. He's written of a turning away from the north by people in the south in the aftermath, a sense that you either followed your rage to its logical conclusion, ever greater retaliatory violence, or you focused your energies elsewhere. Europe, for instance. That's Europe in the political sense, not Europe as I thought of it almost exclusively in those years in the football sense. Talking of which, in the autumn of 1965, Derry City represented Northern Ireland in the European Cup, having won the somewhat confusingly named Irish League the season before. After seeing off the Norwegian side Lynn in the preliminary round, City progressed to the first round proper, a round that mysteriously they never completed. This was a little before my time watching Irish League football, but the story as it came down to me was that the Irish Football Association, the IFA, with its base in Belfast and its, frankly, Protestant board, had ruled that the club's Brandywell Stadium was not up to European standards, despite Lynn having been hosted there a few weeks before. This seems the appropriate moment to mention and applaud the IFA's participation in the Derry UK City of Culture programme, not least its Football for Peace and Football Against Racism initiatives, and the intriguingly named FA Dealing with the Past conference, which will no doubt refer to the fact that Derry City left the Irish League finally in October 1972, while Chuck Londonberry's, did that just happen again? My Ding-a-ling was climbing the UK charts. Because records in those days did climb the charts a couple of places at a time, over weeks and even months, rather than simply appear in them, then just as quickly disappear. Over the weeks and months that followed Derry City's departure from the Irish League, not just the football team, but the city of Derry itself seemed to me, still a child looking on, to become even further adrift, more completely other. But by then, in any case, events in Belfast were outstripping Derry. To tell you the truth, there were several years when I don't remember giving it a single thought. And then along came the Undertones. The Undertones, who made absolutely no concessions in how they presented themselves to the world, but walked into TV studios in whatever they would have worn walking into the local youth club, which is exactly the same as what the rest of us were wearing. Half-mast jeans, bomber jackets, black brogues or Doc Martens. The Undertones, who when asked in an early TV interview why they didn't follow the then trend for singing in mid-Atlantic accents, said that they didn't know anyone who lived in the mid-Atlantic. In fact, if you wanted to read an account of growing up in Derry in those years, growing up anywhere in what some people call the war and other people call the troubles, and I would propose we call as a compromise the euphemism, you could do far worse than Michael Bradley's My Life as an Undertone, originally broadcast on Radio Foyle, where instead of a litany of bombs and bullet dodging, you will read of skites across the Letterkenny to buy instruments on HP and camping trips over the border in Ballyshannon and Bundoran. The Undertones, I need hardly remind anyone here, released Teenage Kicks in September 1978, and I'll not even be cheap and say that they had to come to Belfast to record it, unless, of course, it's cheaper of me to say it while claiming I'm not going to say it. Like thousands of other young people across Northern Ireland, hundreds of thousands possibly worldwide, I was galvanised, shaken awake almost by Teenage Kicks. It wasn't that I hadn't heard music of that sort before, it was just that I hadn't heard anything that good from anyone here, ever. A few years ago, The Guardian ran a poll of readers' all-time top five albums. Mine included Positive Touch, The Undertones' third album, with the exhilarating His Good-Looking Girlfriend and the utterly sublime Julie Ocean. I knew the world was inured against beauty when the single version of Julie Ocean didn't get higher than number 41 in the charts. I still remember standing by the window of the bookshop where I was working at the time, making a show of rearranging books while straining to hear the chart rundown from the speaker hanging in the doorway of the clothes shop next to us. The outrage I felt as though it was my own record when I realised that it hadn't leapt up the charts, leaps, as I say, were rare, though not entirely unheard of, but had fallen back off the Radio 1 playlist, in effect. It was probably about then that I started giving serious thought to writing a screenplay, scored by Undertones music. I, who at that stage had written a single short story for a school competition entitled A World Without Oil, How Can We Cope? And a handful of what I called poems, and a poet to whom I was encouraged by a teacher to show them called Prose with Line Breaks. Jump Boys, I was going to name it, my Undertones movie, in homage to the boys who always got their grinning chops in front of the cameras when international correspondents were trying to deliver their doleful reports from the streets of war-torn Northern Ireland. Whether the world will thank them for it, whether indeed any of you will, the Undertones helped set me on the path that led me to the Playhouse tonight. Who I wish was standing up here with me, however, is a friend of mine. I say a friend of mine, I mean the wife of the brother of a friend of mine. When you spend as long as I do sitting in a room by yourself writing, you tend to cast the net wide in your definition of friendship. This friend, at a slight remove, lives in Paris, but she grew up in Ethiopia at a time in the 1970s that, frankly, in terms of horror, exceeded in almost every measure what was happening here. But there, as here, people were still going about the necessary, gloriously messy business of being teenagers. And there, as here, the radio played a big part. In 1979, there was one song in particular that caught the imagination, the follow-up to the follow-up to Teenage Kicks, Jimmy Jimmy. So popular was the song, in fact, that I seem to recall her saying it spawned something of a youth movement, kids who were known as Jimmy Jimmies. And here's the thing. They had no idea where this record, as redolent of the time and place of its gestation as any of those early Seamus Heaney poems, was coming to them from. I like to think, though, that her Belfast-born husband was able to enlighten her. The Undertones? Didn't you know? They're Canadians.